It's the first Wednesday of the month. Time for a look at Wisconsin's wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Glad to have him along. Glad to have you listening in. If you have a question for him as we move along here, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, and we can talk all things relating to wildlife. Scott, welcome back. Let's talk first about the deer season, a little review of that deer season. Lots of deer shot.
Lots of deer were shot. I think it was a great season by all Wisconsin standards.
You have a great story, though, for opening morning.
Oh, yeah, wonderful story. And I'm really happy to relate it to the listeners, too. As you know, we've talked many times on the program about the subject of avoiding deer on the highway. So at 5:30 Saturday morning, the opening day, November 17th, my son and I were hurtling westbound on 18-151, headed for our traditional spot in Iowa County. I say hurtling, but of course we were doing exactly the 65 miles an hour to get out there on time. And lo and behold, a doe appeared on my front bumper almost instantaneously and hit her dead square on the front of the truck and barely had time to even touched the brakes and just drove right through the collision. Later, I ran into someone who had been behind me and saw the deer go off into the ditch dead, so that wasn't an issue. But anyway, that was my first experience after all these years of driving in Wisconsin and avoiding deer. I did finally participate in the annual issue of Roadkill, and it was I sympathize with folks now that once you've experienced it, you realize how quickly it happens. I also realize that despite the fact that we've talked about lots of avoidance strategies,
sometimes you can't avoid it.
Sometimes you absolutely cannot. There was just no time. The deer was there. I couldn't have swerved. I shouldn't have swerved anyway, and
no.
I didn't swerve. And, there it was. And there I was, too, a few days later, right on the average repair bill of $2,088.12.
Oh, man.
And they say now that the average collision is around a $2,000 cost, so it took the bumper out and the headlights and the grill and a few other things. But it was, it was almost here. It's opening morning, and, headed out to the stand. It was almost like the deer had sort of sent a volunteer to try and take me out. But in any event, we made it out into the woods, and we had a great hunt personally. Saw some deer, ended up with some deer. And overall, the harvest for the nine-day season was right around 344,000 animals.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of deer. The doe kill, I think, was up about 6%, which is probably a reflection of the number of units that had earn-a-buck regulations. So that was good news. Buck harvest was down slightly, but overall, 344 is great. And when you add in the early hunt, the late, especially in the disease eradication zones or herd reduction zones, the late doe season coming up starting tomorrow in most of the rest of the state, the bow harvest, which will likely be very good this year, and the muzzleloader harvest, I think once again we're somewhere in the 500,000 plus or minus mark, which is an excellent harvest. Whether it's enough to stem the continued increase in the deer herd or not remains to be seen, but I know the DNR managers are very enthusiastic and anxious to urge folks to get out this weekend. There's certainly snow.
Yeah.
Plenty of snow, even in the southern part of the state. So it should be a good hunt for antlerless deer for these next 4 days, and that will contribute, again, hopefully, and make an important contribution to the ongoing effort to reduce the herd.
There's before we go to the phones, I wanted to mention a deadline. There's a deadline coming up for those people who like to hunt turkeys, and that's very, very soon.
December 10th. That's a key deadline in permit applications, and there are some other permits due. I think bear applications are due then as well as turkeys. But the big one involving the most people, since I think there are 211,425 permits on the line, which is the most ever, December 10th is the drop-dead deadline. You need to have your application in by then. The good news for those who are forgetful or out of town or whatever is that they've gone to that system in the spring with over-the-counter sales of the remaining permits. So while you might not get your first choice as far as location or time, there will still be an opportunity for some folks who either, for whatever reason, don't apply by December 10th, they'll still have a chance at a turkey permit. But
So there's that opportunity. And Norm in New Auburn has a question for you, and we will go right now to Norm. Norm, hi. Thank you for calling.
Morning.
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 I have a question about the red-breasted nuthatch.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed some of them have a very pronounced redness on their breast, and some are almost gray. Would that be a difference between the male and female?
Good question. Mm-hmm. It's either that or it's a matter of young of the year and adult birds.
Oh.
And I'm not altogether sure which, but any good bird book will, like the Peterson Field Guide, which usually shows sex and age classes kind of all together with a field mark to the...
Oh, I've got one of those, and they don't show it.
Don't show it.
No.
And don't say anything in the description of plumage that would help you out.
No.
Hmm.
Thanks,
well,
anyway.
Well, no, don't give up on us yet. This is kind of like So You Want to Be a Millionaire, where we turn to the audience. So we will turn to the audience and get some. There are plenty of very good birders out there listening, and we just need a call to pin down whether the difference in breast coloration on the red-breasted nuthatch is an age-related or sex-related issue, or both.
So stay listening, Norm.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Scott, before we go back to the phones again, I wanted to bring up this snow and ice situation. Is that going to have an impact on our wildlife?
Well, I'm afraid it probably will, especially if it's persistent and it shows every sign of being so. The real problem was in the southern part of the state last weekend when we had a decent snowfall and then got that miserable freezing rain on top of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I have considerable mass, and I was able to walk on that crust without even hearing it creak.
Yeah.
So it's rock solid and it's fairly thick, and that's going to prevent particularly some birds that either rely on getting down into the snow or into the vegetation to roost or find food. Things like pheasants are going to have a tough time scratching through that or getting through it. Small mammals that normally move up and down in the snow column from the ground surface are going to have a tough time getting through that. And even something like a deer with relatively sharp hooves is going to have trouble running through that if they're breaking through. So if it doesn't soften up a bit so that animals can get through that crust, in some areas of the state, I think that is going to be a problem, especially for things like pheasants.
Stella in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn now. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I'm calling Scott. I'm hoping maybe you can help us. I'm not sure if there's any help, but we have a gorgeous maple tree which has branches going every which way, and last year we decorated it with LED lights with a totally spectacular display.
Mm-hmm.
That the total of the was 96 watts.
Yeah.
So we it lighted up the neighborhood. I mean, it really was spectacular until the squirrels chewed through the wires, ate up the rectifiers, chewed off the plugs. And destroyed it. Do you have any suggestions for decorating a deciduous tree and squirrel repellents?
That's a tough one.
Well, I guess the first question, you describe this maple. Is the maple what we'd call a specimen tree, kind of out in the middle of the lawn, so to speak?
It's between our house and the neighbor's house, and it actually is probably three different... It has one, two, three, four, I'm looking at it now, four trunks that intertwine.
Well, the issue is whether it's spatially separate from other trees and from a roof line. In other words, can the squirrels just jump to it from another tree?
Yes. Well, they jump to it from bushes, and they may jump to it from a spruce, so yes. And
okay.
Roof lines.
Well, if it were a specimen tree, or if by some pruning or other creative landscaping you can keep it separate, then I think there are ways to treat the trunks, either by wrapping them with sheet metal or using something offensive to the squirrels like bird tanglefoot or whatnot that would keep them from climbing the tree from the ground directly onto the tree. Kind of the way you'd put a cone on the pole supporting a bird feeder, but on a larger scale. If that's not possible, if it can't be made separate from other access points, then...
oh, boy.
It's going to be tough. If before you put the materials up, We have the same kind of problem with the tubing used in maple syrup or maple sap collection operations, where the squirrels will chew on the plastic tubing. And in some cases, people have had some success taking a rag or one of these car washing mitts and saturating that with a repellent that squirrels don't like, either something based on hot sauce or thyram, which is a fungicide. There are several products that might help. And then kind of running the tubing through this saturated glove as they put it out. Now, doing that with the Christmas lights, with the number of lights that you describe, might be a little iffy. But if you could create a barrier, you know, 3 or 4 feet up in the tree, using some hardware cloth or whatever else you could to essentially, again, you're defeated by the fact they'll come defeated. In from the top.
Yeah, they can jump from to the tree from a lot of different.
Yeah,
Did you have any suggestion? I mean, obviously, the squirrels are active during the day. Did you see multiple squirrels, or did this seem to be one or two animals that figured out this was something they wanted to do?
Oh, this our area is just we're overrun with squirrels.
Okay, so trapping and removing animals is probably not going to help either. Although, I still think this is probably something that involves selected animals rather than the whole squirrel population, and therefore, if you could, since the trunk has multiple stems, put a little, you know, just a 1x6 board in there flat, so you created a platform to attach either a live trap or whatever type of trap you choose to use, you might be able to selectively remove one or two or three animals that are actually up in the tree doing the damage. It's the only thing I can think of that might help. You can't declare warfare on the whole neighborhood squirrel population. And unless you can make the tree isolated, I think you're going to have a tough time of it.
You're out of luck.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Stella. Stan in Monroe County, your turn. Hi, Stan.
I was wondering about these wild pigs down in Crawford County. Is there a list somewhere of farmers who actually want you to come and hunt them so if you go down, you're not stuck with nowhere to hunt?
The list you're going to find, I think, is the counties where pigs have been reported rather than individual landowners, although there may be some of that. But I think the first thing you should do, Stan, is go on to the – if you have access to the internet – check out the DNR website, and there's a connection on there to a fact sheet on wild pigs in Wisconsin and what the hunting situation is in terms of where the opportunity is and what the regulations are. And I think that would be a good starting point for you. And then if you target a particular county, you mentioned Crawford, but there are certainly others. I think there are some 30 counties in the state where pigs have been reported. Then you might start with the local DNR office in that county or the local NRCS office or other conservation agency, and including Wildlife Services that handle some of the pig-related problems, and see if they can steer you to a landowner where you could possibly hunt.
Yeah, that's probably the best way.
Okay.
All right, good luck. Thank you for calling. And Dirk in Bayview, by the way, are those wild pigs any good to eat?
Yes, I think so, although it depends a little bit on the age and sex class that you obtain and how you and as with any wild meat, how you handle it and take care of it and ultimately cook it. But sure, wild hogs are supposed to be pretty good.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Give us a call with your question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Let's go to Dirk in Bayview next. Hi, Dirk.
Hi, guys. How's it going?
Good.
My story is that I've been watching outside my window being bored, watching a fox limping up and down my backyard frequently. Like, I've seen him occasionally at the corner of KK and Lincoln, of KK and Ellen. But, he's limping, and I got a little puppy running around in my backyard, too, and I don't want it to be eaten by a wild fox. What should I do?
So you say the fox has a limp?
Well, yeah, the limp of the fox is not my concern. My concern is my puppy.
Yeah. Well, I understand that, but I guess there's probably nothing you can do about the fact that there's a fox wandering through the neighborhood. I'm guessing that although people don't always see them, there's either a fox or a coyote or sometimes both wandering through just about every suburban neighborhood in the state. So as a result, I think the issue is you're not likely to gain action from any of the agencies that handle wildlife issues simply because the fox is present. Therefore, I think, as with many cases, especially with free-ranging cats and in some cases with small dogs, for better or for worse, the burden falls to the pet owner to make sure that they're keeping an eye on their animal and either have it contained or under a watchful eye when it's out. Generally, a fox isn't considered a rather serious problem for house pets like a coyote would be, but you know, they can be present in the same area, although foxes and coyotes don't get along all that well either. So the bottom line is the fact that it's passing through and you see it occasionally is probably not going to elicit a response of trying to trap and remove it unless and until it proves to either be a problem in that it's getting into the trash or, you know, chase somebody down the street or actually took a pet, unfortunately, or the whole neighborhood is up in arms. But I'm guessing for everybody like yourself who might be a little anxious about its presence, I'm guessing there's at least another person and maybe more who are thrilled with the opportunity to see the animal. So that's why it gets a little tricky in a suburban neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's definitely pretty to watch it, and then of course I feel pity for it, having a hard time, not only to cross the street with traffic, but with the limp on his left foot.
Yeah,
well, and given the limp and the neighborhood that it's in, it may not be there for long. So that may your problem, Dirk, may be solved by other forces.
Yep. Yeah. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's take another call. Rich in Prairie Farm will go to you next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling.
I just had a follow-up comment about the hunting wild pigs. I spend quite a bit of time in southeast Texas, and there are a lot of wild pigs down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen a couple, but I talked to the folks down there, and they say after about two or three generations, they kind of revert back to a wild pig, and they are absolutely prehistoric looking. They hunt them with dogs down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a couple of guys, they are constantly hauling their dogs to the vets and getting them sewn up.
They're a vicious animal.
And they've got humongous tusks, and I don't think pig hunting's really for the
faint of heart.
The faint of heart.
No.
But and also on the flavor, I've eaten sausage from them, and they're really quite lean.
Mm-hmm.
And from eating acorns and stuff like that, they're a little stronger flavor than what you might think, too.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a domestic pork chop, but maybe a little stringier, a little tougher, and a little gamier. But Larry was just saying he's had them smoked, and I've known some folks who have gone down to Texas and Louisiana to hunt them, and they're pretty... Happy to have the pork to bring it home.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and they. I mean, it's like a regular sport. These guys live to hunt pigs. And,
yep. And as I said, I tried the someone from Rice Lake, as a matter of fact, offered me some when I was visiting his home, and I tried it out, and he had his smoked, and it was quite good, quite good. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Someone checked in on the red-breasted nuthatches, and the Sibley Guide shows the red-breasted, the males having much redder...
That makes sense.
Yeah, coloration than the females. So probably saw a female. That would be my guess. That'd be my guess.
The audience rises up and assists us once again.
Okay. Let's talk about wolves for just a second. How did the wolves make it through the deer season this year?
Well, there's always a little apprehension when I think there were, 640,000 deer licenses sold this year, which is something else we could talk about a little bit because there was a slight decline in that number of licenses. But that aside, with that many armed people in the woods and the potential confusion between coyotes and wolves and so forth, and sometimes a little animosity toward wolves, there's always some concern that wolves are going to be illegally killed during the deer season by mistake or perhaps maliciously. But this year was pretty good news. The release that I saw from Adrian indicated that there were 43 radio-collared or marked wolves that they could follow on the air going into the season. And at least as of a couple of days ago, they could only document one case of a wolf that was dead that was apparently shot. There were a couple other mortalities, but they attributed them to other things. And that's way down from the previous year when a disturbing number of wolves were actually shot. So the good news is they made it through the deer season in pretty good shape.
And the humans did for the most part as well. There were some sad cases, but a couple. But
well, it seems like it's nearly impossible to be accident free. Although that's certainly what we'd like to see. But again, compared to some previous seasons, it was a fairly safe season for the hunters too.
You know, I wanted to bring up one other thing. There was an attack by a black bear attacked a fellow on a deer drive, and he was unarmed. He was just driving, so he didn't have any guns or anything, and someone else came and one of the other drivers came and scared the bear off, but he did get chewed up a little bit.
He did, and that's the kind of thing that certainly captures the public eye when it happens because it seems so spectacular, but it is the issue here is a very unusual phenomenon. First of all, the bears are often in hibernation by the time the deer season rolls around, although it was an early season this year. In most years, the deer hunters and the bears don't overlap in terms of activity patterns, at least to any great extent. And it is a rare circumstance for a black bear. So I don't think it's necessarily, while it's of interest, it's not a trend, and it's not something the public should be greatly alarmed about.
Grace and New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Grace.
Hey, how y'all doing today?
Great.
Hey, Scott. I'm a wildlife ecologist myself.
Great. We need more of them.
Well, one thing, as the previous caller said about y'all were talking about hunting pigs is not for the faint of heart, but it is a blast. it really is. Hunting wild pigs is exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Very exciting. You got to pay attention. It's one of those things that, you know, the more you learn about the animals and where they hang out and what their activity patterns and all are, you know, then you as an individual, even without dogs, can have a better chance of getting one. But hunting pigs with dogs is great fun. And hunting wild pigs does a wonderful service to our native plants and our native birds and all of our native wildlife.
Yep.
I've hunted pigs in several different areas. I've lived in California and down in Florida and all too. So, but you don't need to smoke them. You don't need to make them into sausage. Put those things down in a pit. Get a pit of hot coals burning, burn wood, you know, all morning long, and then cover it up. Cover it up with dirt. Lay if you're in Florida and you've got banana trees around, you lay banana leaves down in there. You can lay other sorts of leaves down there. You can actually just put the dang thing down there in its skin. And you shovel it over, you cover it up with some boards and stuff, some foil and some boards, and shovel a bunch of dirt on top of it, and come back a few hours later, and that just falls off the bone. But you could do it in one of the, in a barbecue, in one of the big barrel barbecues.
Hmm.
And of course, depending on how big a pig you get, I've had several pigs that have been barbecued whole, and meat just falls off and falls apart. There's no fat in there, and it tastes absolutely wonderful.
Well, good. That's good to know.
Can you cover for me, Larry, for the next hour? I'm going to go out
I'm
for lunch.
I'm
going
getting
out
hungry.
For lunch.
Well, now, wait a minute, Scott. You got to come pick me up. I don't know. I don't have my big gun anymore. You do need a pretty good gun to stop them. And trying to shoot a pig in the head is not the greatest idea because that dang skull is so hard, it's likely to bounce the bullet off and piss the pig off.
Well, the key issue, I mean, for listeners not familiar with this and why people might be agitated about wild pigs getting a foothold in Wisconsin, so to speak, they are incredibly destructive environmentally, as well as some potential disease risks in an agriculturally oriented state like Wisconsin. So the issue is where they've somehow gotten here by hook or by crook. The agencies involved, particularly the DNR, would very much like to see them gone, period.
Zero.
Not one. Not, this isn't an issue of creating a pig hunting culture in Wisconsin.
No.
This is an issue of urging people when they have the opportunity to take those pigs off the landscape. And Grace mentioned California. I've been out there on a couple of field trips where pigs are a huge problem in California, as well as the southern states from Texas across Louisiana into Florida. And once they get established, they're very prolific. They have big litters, and they're very hard to deal with. So the issue here in Wisconsin is not, you know, it can be fun, they're great to eat, but we don't want to convey the image that we're trying to promote more pigs because they are great to eat or whatever. This is a case where we really do not want them as part of the Wisconsin faunal landscape.
Yep. All right.
I have another question.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'm just wondering about woodpeckers. Now, I do have to admit that because of some health issues, I have not had my suet blocks and feeders out the last couple of winters. I didn't want to get started on it and then have the risk that I wouldn't be able to continue and have the birds expecting it. So, but just in the walks I take in my woods, I've got about close to 14 acres, most of which is wooded, over 13 acres wooded, in a block of about 40 acres of woods outside of New Glenrothes. And I noticed that I am, on my walks out there, you know, used to be in springtime, I would have whole congregations of red-bellied woodpeckers out there, all competing with each other and all, and trying to see who's the fanciest. And
now they're not.
I'm not seeing that, and I'm wondering if there's anything showing up on the breeding bird surveys, on the winter counts. Is anybody doing work on the woodpeckers and the risks of West Nile virus and what West Nile virus might have done to our woodpecker populations?
Well, let's see where to start on that. I mean, first of all, some of the less common woodpeckers, like redheadeds in particular, are a species that people have been watching for and monitoring in the southern part of the state, and they've become rather rare. Red-bellied's a little less so. I had one on the feeder yesterday.
Yeah, we have one every day.
Storm was starting. And they're a beautiful bird, but they've never been especially common. If you have a pair in the area, you're usually pretty lucky. But the downies and the hairies, the common feeder birds, I don't think anyone's been overly concerned about population change with those birds. But if you want to see the information, then, as we've talked about before, you can go to the several different websites, but the easiest one to use is ebird.org and link to the various bird surveys that Grace was talking about, and you can actually see the plots nationally of where these birds are up, down, or holding their own and know what's going on. But red-bellied have never been overly common, but around. And again, I don't think there's anything major going on with their populations. And whether West Nile's an issue or not, I don't know.
We're not sure. Thanks, Grace. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jeff in Pittsville, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, man. Thank you for your work in education and the outdoors. I just had something to report. Over here west of Pittsville, about 10 miles, my aunt and uncle have been seeing wolves, and there were 7 of them out in their field. And their neighbors have seen as many as 11 in, you know, throughout the field at one time. And I thought that was a very big number for a pack.
It is. Most of the Wisconsin packs are pretty small, but it certainly could happen. It's within the range. Packs can be even larger than that. And it may not have been, you know, it may not necessarily have been one group, or it may have been a couple of groups coming together, but that is unusually large for Wisconsin, at least.
Yeah.
What county are we talking about here, Jeff?
Wood County.
Wood County. You know?
Yeah.
You know, the animals have been moving further south than people thought, and that's probably a number and an observation that if you're willing to pass it along to the folks up in Park Falls, to Adrian and company, who keep track of the wolves around the state, they'd probably like to hear about that.
Okay,
yep.
Good.
All right.
Well, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for calling. And on to Gloria in Madison. Hi, Gloria.
Hi, Larry. Scott, I've had a problem for a very long time with chipmunks, which I thought were moles for a long time. I live on a hill. It's actually a cane. And there are certain levels, and there's one particular hill where they are very active, although they go from the top all the way down to the bottom. Let's see, I'm talking about tunnels now. So.
Yeah.
This one area, you know, they claw dirt out of it. You know, I have piles of dirt that are pulled out of it. But on top of this one area that I'm talking about, there's a flat flagstone path with very large stones. And this year, it's gotten so bad that they're lifting some of these stones and displacing them. I just don't know what to do anymore.
But they're tunneling. Their tunneling is undermining the stones, you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, Gloria, I mean, I think the first issue here is to figure out whether we're really dealing with chipmunks or not. So this is, what you're seeing is strictly a warm season problem.
Yeah, well, what do they hibernate in?
Yes.
Okay.
So anything that of our excavating animals, from chipmunks and 13-line ground squirrels up to woodchucks and a few others, all of those are rodents, and all of them go down for the winter, essentially. So this would have to be a warm season problem, and chipmunks are not notoriously. I gather you've seen the animals.
I've seen the chipmunks so many times, so that's why I finally decided that's what it was.
And have you seen 13-line ground squirrels, or do you know the difference? Or just because they look, they're often mistaken for chipmunks, but they have more stripes on their back than a chipmunk does, but they do a heck of a lot more digging than the common chipmunk. Is this a wooded area or an open area? It's wooded.
Well, not the area that they're doing. It's a very small area that they're lifting up the flagstones. I live in a wooded area, but that area has no woods on it.
When you say lifting up the flagstones, I could see them undermining them and then flagstones subsiding.
Yeah, okay. That's a better.
Because neither of these animals are large enough or powerful enough to really lift large stone.
That's a better description.
Okay. Well, you know, realistically, Gloria, it could be either one. And there are other animals that will pursue both as a food source and do a whole lot more digging while they're trying to dig out the little guys, either the chipmunks or the ground squirrels. But first and foremost, it's a done issue for this year. Everything's frozen up now and covered with snow. They're gone.
Good.
But when things moderate a bit in the spring and they become active again, the first thing I'd recommend you do in the area that's being affected is put out a couple of traps. You can use wire live traps if you're so inclined, or you can use a snap-type trap. Rat trap kind of thing that will kill the animal. That's up to you. I leave that up to you to decide which way you want to go. But I think by doing a little trapping in the area, not only might you help the problem a little bit, but more importantly, you can pin down exactly which animal you're dealing with here, because it does make a difference in terms of how you would go about controlling them, in terms of whether you'd use a rodenticide or more trapping, and really how serious the problem's likely to be. So my suggestion is that you wait until you start to see some activity again next spring. Try and catch a couple of them so we can pin down what you're dealing with, and then give me a call in the wildlife department here in Madison, and I'll be happy to walk you through what your options are. How's that sound?
It sounds good.
All right.
But let me just ask you, the ground squirrels, don't they have more of a squirrely tail? I have ground squirrels also. I know that.
The 13-line ground squirrel and the chipmunk, the tail is virtually the same. The only difference is the way they carry it when they're running. But their size and it does not have a bushy tail. Now, there is another animal that It's possible, although unlikely, that if you might have a population of a fairly rare animal called the Franklin's ground squirrel that does the same kind of digging, tends to live in a colony, often in a hill situation like that, and they do have a bushy tail like a gray squirrel, or at least more bushy. And if that were the case, then that's a very unusual animal. There are folks who have been searching out remnant populations of that ground squirrel for a couple of years now. So it's even more important that we get a picture or a specimen in the spring, and we'll figure out what you've got.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Gloria. Joy in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Joy.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wonder if you can help me identify what I saw. I was house-sitting at a friend's house, and I stepped into the attached garage. And I scared up something out of the recycling bin. It scampered along a piece of plywood and went down, so it was able to go, you know, it was a climber kind of thing. The way I describe it is it was shaped like a tongue depressor. There were no indentations for the neck or much for the tail. It didn't have a teardrop shape like a mouse. It was very fast. It was all one color and kind of a...
Was it all dark charcoal gray?
No, I thought it was more buff brown, but it could be a medium. It was not dark. I don't know. It was so fast.
Did it have a tail?
It had a tail, but it wasn't a tiny little mouse tail. It was a tail that almost looked like its head, you know. It was just real symmetrical looking.
Hmm.
When my friend got home, he said, could it be a vole? And I have no idea. Now, he does live a couple houses down from the park area, and he has some tunneling animals in his yard usually. But I was very surprised. I just didn't know what to think.
Well, there are three possible suspects here. And without the animal, we may never know for sure. But the most likely, when you described it as being more symmetrical and fast, then the first thing that came to mind that would be in a garage this time of year is a short-tailed shrew.
Oh.
Or there are potentially other shrews as well. The short-tailed shrew is more of a gray, silvery gray to dark gray, whereas some of the other ones are more brownish. But the other shrews are about maybe half the size of your little finger. The animal was bigger than that?
Oh, no. Actually, I was going to say it was no more than 3/4 of an inch wide.
How long?
Yeah.
But how long?
I would say about 5 inches long.
Okay, then it was too big for any of the smaller shrews, but it still could have been a short-tailed shrew.
Wow.
And they they are very muscular and cylindrical in appearance, and I guess I probably wouldn't describe them as a tongue depressor like shape, but but nevertheless you wouldn't have seen a distinctive head. But you probably wouldn't have seen any tail either because they have a very short, stubby, small tail. So that's one possibility. And they would certainly be rummaging around in a recycling bin. The other possibility is any one of a number of native field mice, white-footed mice or deer mice, which could have appeared brown, would also have moved very quickly and could come in a variety of colorations from buff brown to rusty brown to gray. They are commonly in garages and outbuildings this time of year for shelter. That one has a long tail, however. And then third, the one you mentioned, the vole, is a stubby animal like the shrew, would be more brownish. You would not see a head. It would look almost like head and tail are indistinguishable, really, except in the direction it's going. But it's very unusual for a vole to actually enter a building. I'm not sure we can tell you for sure, but if I had
those
to guess,
are the options.
If I had to guess, I'd say you saw a shrew.
All right. Thanks, Joy.
Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls in just a minute. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wildlife the Topic with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Scott, our next caller is from Montello. Mark, hello to you.
Hello, Scott.
Good morning.
I had a question about ruffed grouse or partridge in southern Wisconsin. We used to hunt them 15, 20 years ago, and I haven't seen one for 10 years.
Yeah. Well, you're not alone, Mark. They have virtually disappeared from southwestern Wisconsin. When I came here as a graduate student right after the Civil War, actually it was back in the early to mid-70s, and we, too, used to enjoy hunting rough grouse or partridge in southwestern Wisconsin. And, on a good afternoon, you might flush 30 or 40 birds. It was terrific. And, in fact, I was hunting on the same farm during the deer season back 2 weeks ago and commented to my son that, as far as I know, no one has seen a grouse on that farm in probably the last 6 or 7 years. The explanation deals primarily with land use change and habitat change as much as anything else. There are still a few birds around, but they're few and far between and only relegated to a few pockets of dense cover that are still scattered on the landscape. And if you're really curious about this, a colleague of mine at the UW-Richland Center campus, Scott Walter, has just wrapping up a 3-year study of grouse in southwestern Wisconsin, trying to pin down the question that everybody asks, where the heck did the grouse go? And as soon as he gets that published, I think it will get a lot of play because it is a very common concern. But grouse are pretty well gone, and barring some major change in land use or something else in southwestern Wisconsin, they will not be back anytime soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Marilyn in Kansasville, we go to you next. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. The Department of Natural Resources, in its infinite wisdom, some years ago, started to reintroduce turkeys to Wisconsin.
Yeah,
really?
And they've been so successful, they're becoming a problem for some of us landowners.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Racine County, on 32 acres, wooded acres of hickory and oak and various invasive species. And I've got 3 female turkeys that are coming continually and cleaning up around my bird feeder. Yes, they are birds, but I don't wish to be feeding wild turkeys.
Uh-huh.
We did buy corn and put it in another section of the property and thought perhaps they would find it and eat there. No, they're here, and what really tickles me is when I notice that hunters attend these classes and learn the calls and wear the camouflage. And these 3 gals are right on my patio looking in the glass doors. I go out and clap my hands. I literally have to put on a coat and boots and drive them off my immediate yard. And, of course, then they're back again. And let me tell you, turkey feces is awful to clean up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure is.
Is there anything I can do? And would the department come out and remove some of these critters?
No. For the other listeners, Marilyn is referring to the incredible growth in the turkey population statewide since they were reintroduced in 1976. And, a few hundred wild birds were brought in to try and restore a native species to the state. You know, it was a good idea. And we talked earlier in the program about the fact that the turkey permit deadline is coming up here on the 10th. With 211,000 harvest permits on the line, the current estimates of the turkey flock in the state from that reintroduction of a few hundred birds 30 years ago is something over 300,000, maybe 400,000 birds found in the state from Lake Superior to the Illinois line and from Lake Michigan to the Mississippi River. They are all over the place. And the more interesting thing is that they've become far more tolerant of humans and far more tolerant of human land use and suburban development than anybody would have ever imagined. There's quite a turkey population in the UW Arboretum now, and they're roosting on people's houses and the same kind of problems or issues that Maryland's concerned about here. However, there are a couple of things you can do, Marilyn, besides discouraging them to the extent that you can. I mean, they are wild turkeys, and we'd like to keep them wild. The fact that the hunters are learning how to call turkeys and wear camo and so forth is more related to the spring hunting, where only gobblers are fair game, so your 3 gals there are safe. But they're not safe during the fall turkey season. So one thing you could do is, I assume you're in a valid turkey hunting zone. You can find that out from the DNR, and invite a few folks who have a fall turkey hunting permit for that unit to come out and sit in your woods. And I think that those gals will become.
They don't even have to sit in the woods. They can wait in the house in the warmth.
Well,
the birds come at 7:30 in the morning and 3:30 in the afternoon.
But that would take some of the mystique out of the turkey hunting. But
if they will loan me the shotgun, I will take the mystique out of it.
Well, that's another possibility, Marilyn, is that you or your family members are quite, you know, welcome to apply for a fall turkey hunting permit and take matters into your own hands, so to speak. So the hunting issue is one thing, whether you do it yourself or have somebody invited onto the property. If the bird feeder is the issue, I think that you could probably fairly easily design a feeding station with I'm trying to think of the easiest material to use. If it were me, I've got some 8-foot sections of what they call hog panel or whatnot, which is an 8-foot section of very heavy 6-inch mesh. It's heavy gauge wire, but mm-hmm. these are freestanding, and it would be easy to put 4 of those in a square. And even put one over the top if necessary, although I'm not sure the turkeys would drop down into a small.
They are more or less, they aren't actually getting into my feeder, which is
below.
On a pole, but they're doing the ground feeding, and I like to have ground feed on for some of the birds really prefer that, like the junco.
Absolutely, I understand that. What I'm suggesting is that you could create an enclosure, you know, 8 feet by 8 feet, that the turkeys couldn't get through, but all the little birds would easily pass through this mesh and be able to go about their business.
Oh, okay.
And all you'd have to do is have one corner wired so you could, with a twist tie kind of thing,
yeah.
So you could lift it out to fill your feeders. Turkeys are out, birds are in, everybody's happy.
Yeah. Give that a shot. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And probably a lot of hunters would like to visit you in Kansasville or Maryland.
Sounds like Maryland's place would be a good place to hunt.
Bob in Wauwatosa, it's your turn next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. Scott, what can you tell me about the migration habits of great horned owls? We have a lot of them in our neighborhood. We have many mature oaks in the neighborhood, big, tall oak trees. And the great horned owls seem to come and go. And I know they're great horned owls because they're large and look like, the few glimpses I've got, they look like the pictures in the books, and also because you guys played owl mm-hmm. sounds on one of your programs. Mm-hmm. So I know they're great horned owls, but they seem to come and go. What's going on?
Well, I think the coming and going is more local movements and different behaviors making them differentially visible at different times of the year. They're, in a general sense, they're not coming or going anywhere. They're non-migratory. So those are resident birds that usually take up occupancy of an area but may move around within a local, you know, 80 or 160-acre tract, depending on what they're feeding on, depending on whether the young ones are present, and depending on whether they're using their nest tree or not. They're one of the earliest nesting birds we have, so, I mean, we're really, here in mid-December, we're not that far away from the start of the horned owl nesting season, you know, after the first of the year. And at that time of year, they're very conspicuous because people hear them hooting, and they're more conspicuous to see when the leaves are down. But the reality is they're around somewhere throughout the year.
Okay.
Yep.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And Katie in Winchester, hi to you.
Yes. I found a dead bat on my door stoop. Now, I thought they migrated at this time of year, but is this an indication that I may have a problem with them as far as nesting in my garage?
When did you find the bat? Just recently?
This morning. Just
this morning.
Right.
Hmm.
It's cold.
It's very cold.
Mm-hmm.
The chances are that bat in that site, I'm just trying to figure out...
What kind of bat?
What kind of bat, maybe. Can you describe... we know it's a bat, so was there anything about the fur color or anything like that that was unique? Was it by any chance kind of a rusty brown, like a red fox color?
No, I thought it was more grayish.
Okay, and it was fairly small?
Right. He was laying yellow up there.
Well, had it been rusty brown, that would be a red bat, and they're migratory. And it's still possible that one of those, I've seen them as late as the deer season, flying around still, one of those could have been caught in migration and just perished there. But the way you describe it, it's more likely a little brown bat, maybe even a big brown bat, and more likely to be related to the fact that there are some of them in your porch, in the soffit, in the roof line, somewhere in the building, and that this one got caught outside, fell outside, made a wrong turn at the bat entrance or something, and ultimately was done in.
So they don't migrate?
Some do, some don't. The red bat does migrate, like a bird might, further south. The little browns and some others make local migrations from, say, the house they may live in during the summer to a mine shaft or a cave where they spend the winter. Others of the same species will just remain in a house all year if, in fact, the insulation is such and the access is such that in an attic or wall space they can find the temperature regime they're looking for. The only thing that... So there's two issues here, Katie. One is that the bat could be indicative of bats in your building. The other, with a single bat down, when they're down and like that, there's a higher probability, not a high probability, but a higher probability that it was sick. And it might be a bat that you'd want to have tested for rabies or some other consideration.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. World of Wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist now. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Scott, you know, the holiday season is here, and there are a lot of great gift ideas out there. And before we go to the phones, let's talk about some of the great gifts that we might consider purchasing this year.
It seems like there are more neat gadgets and things to think about for the outdoor enthusiast with every passing year. And I'm guessing there are still some people out there who may not have finished their Christmas shopping yet. So for those folks, you know, or folks who may have their interest piqued here and want to go out and get something extra, if you have a friend or family member who likes the outdoors from virtually any standpoint, of course, with wildlife, we're primarily thinking about bird feeding and bird watching and hunting and fishing, of course, and other kinds of things like that that relate to wildlife. But there's just a wonderful array of products and general categories of things you might consider. Among those, of course, there are new books on the market all the time. Identification books. I mean, you can't go wrong with field guides. We've talked before about these new guides that are out for animal tracks and sign. People are often calling about, gee, what did I see? Or I found some tracks, or I found a dropping or something. Those books by Mark Elbrock, Mammal Tracks and Sign and Bird Tracks and Sign, and there's a new one on skulls too, are terrific. All the field guides, all the how-to books on landscaping for wildlife, bird feeding, and it just a ton of books. The other category I'd urge you to think about are optics. Boy,
yeah.
There are some fabulous optics. There's some fabulous optics equipment on the market now, and it can be pricey. With optics, you get what you pay for in terms of quality. But in terms of good quality binoculars, range finders, spotting scopes, tremendous range, and some great stores that will help you get exactly what you want, either for yourself or for someone else. Another thing that came up last year and has really come on strong are the use of these motion-sensitive cameras, trail cameras, scouting cameras. There are lots of names for them, but they've become very sophisticated and easy to use. And, you know, people are just spending all kinds of time monitoring what's going on with these remotely triggered cameras. And I think for any landowner, you don't necessarily have to hunt or be monitoring big bucks on your land, just knowing what's out there. In your backyard, including the neighbors sneaking around. You never know what you're going to photograph. But putting one of these cameras out and just kind of checking things out adds a whole new dimension to what's going on outside. And another thing I think is particularly useful, subscriptions or memberships. There are many wonderful conservation organizations out there. And sometimes people, you know, oh, no, I didn't think about joining or I didn't get around to it. So, again, a gift membership to a group like Pheasants Forever, Ducks Unlimited, or Whitetails Unlimited, or the Rough Grouse Society, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. There are scads of them, Wild Turkey Federation. A membership there gives the recipient an opportunity to attend their banquets and fundraisers and other activities, as well as getting their publications. And for somebody who's enthusiastic about one of those species, it's a neat idea. On another front, I mean, I use a lot for information, Wisconsin Outdoor News.
It's a great newspaper.
Newspaper format, comes out biweekly, but in terms of keeping track of what's going on the things we talk about, like permit deadlines or what the hunting season outlook or what the hunting season success was or where to go fishing or regulations, legislative changes, Outdoor News is a great investment for any outdoor enthusiast. Similarly, the DNR's magazine, Wisconsin Natural Resources, is also a great local one. But there are many other great magazines and these memberships. Often the membership comes with a magazine that's unique to the group. On the hunting and fishing front, I mean, the array of gadgets is almost endless. And it never seems that they become more sophisticated every year with gadgets to help you stay warm, shoot better, catch more fish, see more fish. Fishing.
It's unbelievable.
Fishing lures. Unbelievable suggestion. I mean, great stocking stuffers there. And other kinds of gadgets from boots and clothing and sunglasses and hats. And it's
unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. So as you're doing your Christmas shopping, you know, think a little bit about somebody who's interested or enthused about wildlife and get them a bird feed. Well, bird feeders and seed. There's another idea. You know, all sorts of stuff.
Lots out there and lots of people online. So we'll go back to the phones. And John in Green Bay has been patiently waiting. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Hey, you guys were talking a month or two back about perching birds and whether they actually would carry stuff in their feet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I can assure you we hand-feed the gray jays up in northeastern Vilas County, and they take anything they can with their feet.
Really? I'll be darned.
They'll come right off your hand with a piece of pizza or anything that they got, and they'll fly to their tree with it. There's no doubt about that. I've been observing that for a number of years now.
Huh.
There is no shortage of chickadees either up there because we started banding this year. We hand-feed the chickadees and nuthatches. We feed year-round, my son and I, and we've banded 20 chickadees so far this year.
Wow, that's pretty neat.
And they just keep coming in. We got about at least another four or five to do. So, and third, we have a nesting pair over the last couple of years, a nesting pair of broadwing hawks, which is real interesting. We don't cut down the dead trees. We let them let the pileateds pound the holes in. And I've been watching these. They move from tree to tree. But I noticed, and it's a definite observation, because I saw it happening in the morning and in the evening as the pileateds move by, but one of the broadwing hawks last fall, wasn't this fall, the year before, was actually following that pileated woodpecker around. And I can only imagine that he was, you know, perhaps looking for a future nesting site, but there was absolutely no doubt about it, because when that pileated moved from a dead birch, that broadwing went to the next tree it went to and just followed it around. So
maybe it was looking for a meal.
Well, due to the fact that the pileated is larger than the broadwing, yeah. I think it would have been either very, very hungry or it didn't have the eyes it needed.
I wouldn't want to get wrapped by a pileated. It's interesting, John, if you're interested in chickadee banding, and this brings up another gift idea, a copy of Sand County Almanac by Aldo Leopold. But there's a neat little passage in Leopold's book about chickadee banding and a particular band number and how that bird was followed through the years. You might enjoy it if you've been enjoying banding chickadees.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling, John. Appreciate your input. I want to give some others a chance here. Let's get Pat in Land O'Lakes online here. Pat, hi.
Hi. I have a suggestion for you. We took a rib cage from our deer, and we've got it hanging in the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And the birds just absolutely love it.
Mm-hmm.
It's inexpensive, and Everything. We've got birds on there. You don't even have to buy bird seed. Someone who can't afford bird seed.
There are, I mean, it's a good use of the remains of a carcass. I have a feeling, Pat, that the general acceptability, and I know a lot of people in the Northwoods who do that, but the general acceptability of having the remains of a deer carcass hanging in a tree in the front yard is probably slightly different in Lando than in my neighborhood outside Madison. But, but nevertheless, I do
that
have...
That is a good idea.
I did save all that. One of the does that I processed was as fat as any deer I've ever seen, and I took lots of suet and fat on that, and that's tacked up next to my suet feeder for the birds. So that's my version of doing what you're doing.
Well, we just do a little piece. We don't do the whole thing.
Okay.
We just do a little piece, and it's very enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great idea. Thanks,
idea.
Pat.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call. Let's go to Mike in Presque Isle next. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Okay. Great show, Larry. And Scott, I'd like to say thank you for your work at WXPR in Rhinelander during your recent sabbatical in the North Woods. We love listening to you.
Well, thank you. I hope I can somehow get back involved there at some point.
Wonderful. We were talking about turkeys before. And here in the far, far North Woods, we got a visit from eight of them 2 weeks ago for the first time, been here 10 years. And this is dense woods, no oaks to be seen anywhere, no small aspen throwing off catkins, boreal forest, it's basswoods and 75-year-old aspen toppling and balsam fir, very thick. So I'm wondering a couple of things about these new visitors that are showing up at our bird feeders here. It's interesting to see them. First of all, I'm wondering in this particular kind of ecotone what they would be eating. We've got more than a foot of snow on the ground right now. And second of all, I've heard, and I'm sure you have heard through the years, people contending that this species of ground nesting bird is usurping the grouse populations in different areas. I'm wondering if there's any proof of that, if there's any studies ongoing, and what you may think about that.
Okay.
Well, first of all, turkeys in the far North Woods is a bit of a surprise to some people. Part of it's related to the fact, and their persistence there is related to the fact that snow's been hard to come by in some parts of the North Woods the last few winters. This year may be a little different, and if we do get prolonged deep snow, or if you get any of the miserable freezing rain that we had, those turkeys are going to have a tough go of it. It is primarily oak mast and other hard mast that they rely on in the North Country, but I think a major factor in keeping those turkeys around some areas, not just bird feeders, but also the fact that there's a fair bit of baiting going on in the woods up there for deer during the deer season, and also lots of deer feeders that the turkeys are taking advantage of, because there's not much agriculture to rely on. So I think their persistence in the North Woods is more dependent on human activity and the weather than it is on their own capabilities, so to speak. And the notion that the large and burgeoning turkey population has had negative effects on grouse or any other species that I know of, I don't believe there's any substance to that at all.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mike, for calling. Jim and Mason, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, guys. I live up here in Mason, but I hunt on a home farm down in Marquette County.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a strong supporter. I'm very happy with the return of wolves up here in the North Country. But as you know, and as said, you can't hunt coyotes up here
right
during the deer season, but you can down in Marquette where I hunt. And I feel a little guilty about it, but I was hunting on my deer stand on the second day. A coyote ran across in front in the field, and so I shot it.
Mm-hmm.
And as I didn't want to wreck my hunting, so I didn't go down to it. And I'm sitting there and looking at it, and it looked too dark for me. When I walked up to it later, it was the size and shape of a coyote, but it's black, with not entirely black, but certainly black in appearance, and with white hairs on it. and its legs were substantially heavier. The entire body was substantially heavier built, stockier built than a coyote. Feet were larger, the legs were definitely heavier. It frightened me at first, especially until I got up close to it, because it couldn't have been a wolf. And, of course, it wasn't a wolf, but it wasn't a coyote like the coyotes that I have seen and shot in other years. I suspected it was a cross, dog-coyote cross. Can that occur, and does it occur?
It does. Wolf-dog hybrids and coy dogs, as they're sometimes called, are a management issue, and particularly in the Northeast, coyote-dog hybrids have been an issue for a long time, northeastern part of the country, not Wisconsin. But, well, that's a possibility. When you say it was not a wolf, is that based on the fact that you've seen lots of coyotes, or...
I've seen lots of coyotes, and I've also seen quite a few wolves. I have a degree in wildlife biology, and we did measure it and took different measurements on it. But I mean, it certainly wasn't an adult wolf, and there wouldn't be any reason for a juvenile wolf to be there. I wouldn't think anyway. But
well, I don't know what you killed, Jim, but it points out exactly the point you were making when you started, that the reason there's no coyote hunting in the north part of the state to protect wolves is because they're so darn hard to tell apart in a field situation, that it's too much to expect the average deer hunter, who may not have your experience with either animal, to make that call in a field situation, and therefore coyotes have to be protected at that time of year in order to protect the wolves. Now, as wolves begin to expand their numbers and range further south, it's quite possible that ban on coyote hunting or coyote shooting during the deer season may have to be extended. Whether you're an example of that, or whether this is just an example of the difficulty in identification is up for grabs at this point. But there certainly have been cases of juvenile wolves shot where, even the folks who know what's going on have to take a second look and a careful look in order to make that call. So this is exactly why they are protected from shooting during the deer season, and maybe that needs to be moved further south. But I don't know what you shot. Hopefully it wasn't a wolf. If it was a hybrid, then so be it. Probably a good thing getting a hybrid out of the population.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Jim. Thank you very much. Pat in Mazamani, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm hoping you can identify a bird feather for me. I'm thinking it might be a sharpshin because we've had a sharpshin hawk hanging around recently. But it's about a 4-inch long feather from the quill tip, or from the quill to the tip.
Mm-hmm.
And it grades in tone from a darkish gray to a black to a white tip. And between the gradations, there's sort of an exaggerated parentheses.
Yeah.
So from gray to black, from black to white, it's quite exaggerated.
To white. Gray to black to white. That's a tough one without seeing it.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And I'll tell you what, Pat, the best way to get that feather identified is to... Do you have you still have the feather?
Yes, it's right in front of me.
I mean, you could either photograph it or stick it in an envelope and send it to us. And what we would normally do, it may be possible to identify it just by looking at it, but we have a reference collection both in wildlife ecology and in the zoology museum where there are plenty of sharpshin specimens as well as other birds, and it's often easiest with a single feather to compare it to a specimen where you can then determine what part of the body it came off of and whether it in fact belongs to that species or not.
Oh, interesting. Is that collection open to the public?
if you were in town at some point and, you know, came by with a feather, we go in and, you know, and look around at some specimens, at least in the wildlife collection. The Zoology Museum, which is much larger, is a research collection in a controlled environment and so forth, and it's not open to wander around in. But certainly, the you know, we could arrange with the curator to have a couple of specimens, you know, brought out so that you could compare your feather.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Pat. And Don in Fort Atkinson. Let's see. Let's get Don on here. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Everybody likes a rare bird at their bird feeder, and I'll precedent this by saying I feed a lot of birds. I feed about 300 pounds of feed a year, and I have the standard nut hatches, both red and white breasted and so forth. Now, I'm going to lay a bird on you for just a second here.
Yep.
I think I have a Townsend's warbler. Been here about 2.5 weeks. Now, if you look at your key, you will see that it's indigenous to the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So you will cross-key it to a black-throated green warbler.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been a female. But I'm sitting right here, and I'm looking 3 feet away from me. And it's got all the characteristics of a female Townsend's warbler, right down to the little patch of yellow that is underneath its black eye patch. Now, tell me, me it's not possible that this Townsend's warbler could be here, and I can accept that.
Oh, I would never, we would never, never do that.
Never.
You know, you seem to know what you're doing. You've got the bird books and so forth. You know, the one of the key elements of birding is this notion of rare birds, and we just finished talking last month about that rare Central American hummingbird, the green mango that was down in Beloit, and
right, just south,
you know,
of us.
Whoever thought that would be there, and it generated incredible interest. If in fact that's what you've got, you know, you'll have to decide whether you want to make its location, and if it's a regular visitor, there'd be lots of birders who would like to come and see that. Whether that bird's been reported in Wisconsin or not, I'd have to look in the Birds of Wisconsin or in Temple and Cary's Wisconsin Seasonal and Geographic Bird Guide, which lists all of the rarities that have been seen. I don't remember offhand, but if that's what it is, then you certainly could report that to the Rare Bird Hotline at Madison Audubon, and the word would get out, and you'd have you'd have lots of visitors.
You ought to get a picture of it.
I have a picture on my digital camera,
mm-hmm.
and it is as close-up as you're going to get. And it came about 2.5 weeks ago, and it sat there, and every day I get up, even with the snow and ice, and I say, can't be here today. I'm sitting in my living room looking out the window this morning about quarter after six, and there it sits, and it sits there until the morning doves come. I feed about 20 morning doves,
mm-hmm.
and when they come, it chases it away. But it is healthy. It's eating my little cakes of suet, and it looks like it's cracked sunflower seeds, and it's definitely a warbler. There's no doubt about that. But
warblers are tricky, and I certainly don't consider myself an expert in warblers. Would have to see it face up anyway. But if you decide you want to let the word out or have some other people come and confirm it for you, I would urge you to at least do that so you can satisfy in your own mind that that's what you have.
Yeah, you should do
good
that.
Good luck.
Good luck. And Kevin in Madison, quick comment from you.
Hey, Larry and Scott, it's Kevin out at the Arboretum.
Oh.
How you guys doing?
Great.
Oh, pretty good.
Good. I just wanted to put in a quick plug for the Arboretum Bookstore.
Ah, good idea.
Great place for nature books, environmental studies books, and an assortment of really nice trinkets that I think a lot of your listeners would appreciate coming to take a look at and then going for a hike.
There you go. The Arboretum is a great place to visit this any time of year, but check out the gift shop, and for that matter, nature centers all over the state. Most of them have a nice gift shop with all sorts of good stuff. Thanks for calling, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin McSweeney directs the UW-Madison Arboretum, and it's great to have him on. And it is a great place to go at any time of the year. And it's also great to have you on, Scott, and I assume you'll be back the first Wednesday of next.
Which I think is January 2nd, the day after the Badgers Bowl victory, and we'll be celebrating that. And in the meantime, happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays to you as well. Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist, our guest today, and he'll be back on January 2nd, and we'll talk with him some more about the world of wildlife. Just to let you know, coming up tomorrow at 11 o'clock, Dr. Bill Scheckler of Madison has an update on the flu season. I got my flu shot, so I don't have the flu, and I hope I don't get it. And Dr. Lowell Lakritz of Madison talks with us about good dental hygiene. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.